This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Economic collapse almost certain to spiral into violence and totalitarianism, environmental disaster. Writer Chris Hedges argues that he knows who's responsible for that bleak future. The Democratic Party, churches, unions, the media, artists, and academia, the liberal establishment, as he calls them. Whether the motive was fear, careerism, or self-preservation, Hedges argues that timid liberals marginalized themselves, purged the radicals in their own ranks, and sold out. Without a powerful liberal class to check the excesses of capitalism and corporate power, global warming and class warfare could inaugurate centuries of barbarism, he writes. Well, liberals, do you believe your institutions and causes have failed? 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the program, NPR Senior Foreign Editor Lauren Jenkins on foreign policy after the midterms. But first, my old friend and colleague Chris Hedges joins us from our bureau in New York. His new book is Death of the Liberal Class. And Chris, nice to have you back on the program.
Thanks, Neil.
And all of that from a product of the liberal class.
Yes, it's kind of, I suppose, a lover's quarrel with the liberal class.
A little bit more like a quarrel. you're presiding over the postmortem here.
Well, I have liberal institutions are absolutely vital for a democracy. They are that mechanism or safety valve that makes incremental and piecemeal reform possible. You saw it with the collapse of capitalism in the 1930s. It was labor unions, an independent press, a progressive wing of the Democratic Party led by Roosevelt and Henry Wallace that made possible the New Deal. You saw it again with the civil rights movement, with the grievances of African Americans. There was a mechanism within the system with which to redress those grievances. And I argue that that safety valve has been turned off, that the mechanism no longer exists. And I think we saw that with the last elections.
Well, let's take those institutions one at a time. For example, you say the Democratic Party. A lot of people would say that in some ways the election before this last one was a redemption of the promises of Martin Luther King.
Well, I think we've had 2 years to find out that that was not the case. And I think you're right that many people felt and believed and yearned for that kind of a change, but we didn't get it. What we got was a Democratic Party that I think since the Clinton administration has rather cravenly served corporate interests and refused to restructure the society, confront the permanent war economy, and make the kind of changes that I think many people who invested their hopes in Barack Obama expect for and wanted.
Well, many of those people perhaps, but you don't win elections in this country running to the left.
No, you don't. But I think that the system is teetering close towards dysfunction, and that for millions of Americans, including the 15 million unemployed Americans, half of whom have been jobless for 21 weeks or more, the suffering is becoming acute. We are coming close to creating a kind of permanent underclass. I mean, the figures alone, I think, are staggering. Having just written a story out of Camden, New Jersey, for The Nation magazine, which is out this week, which per capita is the poorest city in the country, when you get up close and see the human cost of what this has done, these foreclosures, these bank repossessions, the fact that 1 in 8 Americans and 1 in 4 children depend on food stamps to survive, 40 million Americans in poverty, tens of millions of Americans in category called near poverty, and the system has failed to respond. It is not in any way ameliorated their difficulty and their pain, and I think in a functioning democracy, when you have functioning liberal institutions, you would be able to begin to respond to these problems. Instead, we pass a jobs bill that provides $15 billion in tax credits to corporations. That's not a solution.
Yet you point out it yourself. You cited the example of the Great Depression. Things were very much worse, not to denigrate or play down the true suffering that's going on today, but things were very much worse in the 1930s. And a lot of people would argue it was not the New Deal that brought the economy around. It was the Second World War.
Well, you're right. In terms of unemployment, that's true. But remember that the New Deal created millions of jobs through the Federal Works Program. It gave us Social Security. It provided emergency measures. Remember, the end of Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath is about these government-run camps that migrants from the Dust Bowl can finally eat and survive and take care of their families. So there was heavy government intervention, and I think that with the economic meltdown and real unemployment, as the Los Angeles Times estimates, running around 17% by the time you count people who are either stop looking for work or have poorly paid part-time jobs. And you know, people who have these part-time jobs in places like Walmart, you work 28 hours a week, your real wages put you below the poverty line. The staggering numbers of people, 8,000 people a day for the last 2 years have been thrown out of their homes. And yet we've not responded to this crisis. Yes, it has not, as you correctly point out, reached the levels of the Great Depression, but many reputable economists, including Paul Krugman in today's New York Times, warns that if we don't radically change our tact, it will.
We'll move on to academia, an institution in which you've also spent a fair amount of your time.
Well, there's been a kind of withering of the humanities, those the liberal arts education that asks the broad questions, the challenges, structures, and assumptions, and a corporatization of all universities, especially if you look at state universities. Departments have to raise their own funds, their own grants, often their own salaries. This is pretty hard to do if you're in the classics department. You've had the rise of for-profit universities and a kind of purging within economics departments and business schools of people who challenged what I would call the utopian vision of globalization, the idea that somehow the marketplace should determine human behavior and guide human activity. I don't think there's anything in about 3,000 years of economic history to justify it. What we've done is create, in essence, vocational schools. So education is becoming increasingly vocational, even in the elite schools where I've taught, Princeton, Columbia, NYU. We create classes of systems managers, people who know. Lawrence Summers would be the perfect example of this. Highly astute and intelligent in a kind of analytical way, and yet I think they only know how to service a particular system. The banking collapse can be laid at the feet of Summers, who was in 1999 the Treasury Secretary under Clinton, and yet he's brought back into the Obama White House to handle the mess that he created.
Specifically, you wrote that universities shifted Marxist analysis away from economic departments, most of which had been taken over by free market ideologues anyway, to disciplines within the humanities where Marxist critique would not threaten systems of power. Shifted Marxist analysis away from economic departments. Marxism was perhaps one of the great catastrophic failures of the 20th century.
Without question. Created a way to essentially find another mechanism to enslave the working class. And yet, I don't think you can be literate in terms of understanding political discourse if you're not familiar with Marx, that the language of class warfare, the understanding of how unrestricted capitalism works, was something that Marx did understand. I'm with you. I mean, Marxism is also a kind of utopianism, like globalization, like fascism, like any other ism, that justifies human suffering for that ultimate paradise. And this is this dislocation of the American working class, the destruction of the manufacturing base. 9% of our working class now it works in manufacturing, was always justified because of that panacea that would be provided by the global marketplace. Well, it didn't turn out that way.
You also champion the communist unions, the American communist unions, including the Wobblies.
Yeah. Well, the Wobblies were probably better described as anarchists rather than communists. But the communists, along with the anarchists, along with the socialists, created a broad kind of popular front that on the eve of World War I were really changing, reconfiguring the United States. You had not only socialist mayors elected in some few dozen cities, you had Appeal to Reason or the Masses. These socialist publications had broad appeal. 1912, Eugene Debs brought in 1 million votes, and the power elite was disturbed by it. They were unsettled by it. And we saw with essentially World War One. Dwight MacDonald writes about how, you know, the war was the rock on which progressive movements broke. And I think that's correct. When you look at the rise of mass propaganda under the Creel Commission or Committee for Public Information, the inculcation of fear, the uniformity of opinion, because, of course, as soon as World War One ended, the hated Hun became the hated Red, the internal witch hunts, I think all of that weakened and decimated liberal institutions to our detriment.
Yet on the eve of World War II, did you not have those same unions and those same communists in league with the fascists as they carved up Eastern Europe?
Exactly. And that, of course, deeply discredited the communist movement. Remember, with the breakdown of capitalism, a lot of people on the left flirted with communism. And what soured them on communism was precisely the pact that was signed between Stalin and Hitler. And the abrupt about-face and hypocrisy on the part of the communist movement, which swung from being anti-fascist, virulently anti-fascist, to suddenly being allied with the fascists. So without question. But I think that that radical left, and I share all of your distaste for communism for and orthodox Marxism. The important point is that these radical movements held fast against powerful corporate interests. And it's really because of them that we got things like the 8-hour working day and the 40-hour week and pensions and, Social Security. I mean, these were all a product of these movements. And while, the communist unions were not something I would have joined, I think that our country was impoverished for their decimation.
We're talking with Chris Hedges about his book, The Death of the Liberal Class. Liberals, do you believe your institutions and causes have failed? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In his latest book, Chris Hedges excoriates liberals and liberal institutions for failing America. The liberal class, he writes, continues to speak in the prim and obsolete language of policies and issues. It refuses to defy the corporate assault. A virulent right wing, for this reason, captures and expresses the legitimate rage articulated by the disenfranchised, and the liberal class has become obsolete even as it clings to its positions of privilege within liberal institutions. You can learn more about Chris Hedges' five pillars of the liberal class and how each one has failed in an excerpt from Death of the Liberal Class at our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation and Liberals, Do You Believe Your Institutions and Causes Have Failed? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And we'll start with Jerry. Jerry's on the line from O'Fallon in Missouri.
Good afternoon. I think I kind of misinterpreted the your guest's point of view, but I certainly do agree. I mean, if we want to start listing some radical liberal ideas, we might start with the elimination of child labor and then a 6-day work week and then a 5-day work week, state-sponsored land-grant universities, which we have in virtually, I guess, all 50 states, access to education to the common person. And a lot of people take these for granted, and yet the word liberal is still considered almost an epithet. And I do agree that no one seems to be able to address the fact that there are people among us that are less privileged, less fortunate, by no fault of their own. I think we have come to a position where the easy the philosophy to fall back on is, of course, to blame the victim because they obviously did something wrong, which is kind of a strange kind of superstition. But I think a lot of people really don't understand what the liberal philosophies of, say, 100 years ago, as you were speaking about the Wobblies, how many people even know, you know, what the IWW really was, and simply don't understand that has brought us to where we have gotten to, and we're kind of receding from that point. And, of course, if you look across the ocean to Western Europe, they have what many people here would call an extremely liberal, 6 weeks vacation, government-guaranteed pensions, and I think their quality of life and their stability and crime rates, et cetera, are much more favorable than our own.
Well, Chris Hedges, I think you might argue Jerry makes your point by pointing out that all of those accomplishments he talks about were the progress of the, well, progressive movement and the labor movement 100 years ago.
Well, the liberal class was a bridge. It was a kind of middle ground between radical movements, many of which we have mentioned, and a capitalist or corporate elite. And there was a kind of collusion with the class whereby reform was not radical. Reform was, as Karl Popper argues it should be, piecemeal and incremental. And in fact, that liberal class becomes absolutely vital, especially in times of turmoil or disquiet, to maintaining stability. And so much of what we do take for granted, as your caller correctly points out, is the product not simply of the liberal class, but of the pressure of these popular movements, which have now largely been decimated.
Jerry, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Let's go next to, this is Ian. Ian with us from Milwaukee in Hawaii.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
Thanks. I wondered if two things might also be killing the liberal, the progressive agenda in the United States. I wonder what your guest might think of how much of a progressive agenda might have gotten some legs and gotten some results if it wasn't for the Senate, where, you know, the Senate, where basically, you know, progressive and liberal ideas go to die, because if you don't have 60 votes and a filibuster-proof majority, nothing that, for instance, some of the more progressive items that came out of the House through legislation got just fell dead in the Senate. And then the other part was the corporate-controlled media seems to be a complete reversal of what the media is in a free press role is supposed to be in a democratic society. And I hate to criticize NPR too, Neil, but to some extent I think that even outlets that are more thoughtful like NPR don't, you know, they focus on the chatter between shades of gray and not on real differences on how we got to this point and what different alternatives there are to overcome problems, and just sort of focus on the debate between talking heads. I hate to do that to you, but it's...
This is a point that Chris raises in his book, both directly and obliquely, because NPR, like some other institutions he describes as liberal, very much adheres to the idea that we should try to be objective and present both sides, which he describes as... he worked for both institutions for quite a while, the New York Times, longer than he did for National Public Radio. But Chris, you say that's a false position and absurd.
Well, you know, there's a difference between news and truth. News is about recording an event, an occurrence. Truth is about something else. One can have a story that's factual. The New York Times printed many of them in the lead up to the war, and at least the quotes and the interviews that they carried out with White House officials were correct, but they turned out to be untrue. And I think that there's a kind of cynicism, and I don't want to pick on outlets like the New York Times or NPR, which still do journalism. Commercial media has largely, in my mind, walked out on journalism completely for celebrity gossip.
I think they still have ads in the New York Times, but go ahead. Yeah.
My concern is that there's a kind of cynicism where, you know, you give one side that you may very well sitting in the middle of the studio know is untrue, and then give another side that's untrue, and somehow that's balanced. And I think that there are, you know, we are a society utterly awash in lies, public relations industries, spin doctors, and they create. Have powerful mechanisms to create and disseminate information that that are quite effective in shaping the debate. I mean, I think the healthcare issue is a good one, in that Physicians for a National Health Plan out of Harvard Medical School, all made up of doctors, critiqued the health plan, laid out, I think, a case as to why our for-profit healthcare industry is inefficient. Doesn't work. 33 cents out of every dollar goes towards corporate profits. 45,000 Americans died last year because they couldn't afford medical care, made a strong case for public option. In essence, they couldn't be heard. They couldn't be heard because commercial media outlets locked them out, and they were literally locked out of the debates in the Democratic primaries because the only persons carrying their banner, Dennis Kucinich, wasn't allowed to participate in most of the debates. There's been a terrible corrosion within the media. And, you know, Neil can tell you when we began working in Latin America, all of the major networks had bureaus, reporters. They went out, they reported, they produced. That's all vanished.
Ian, thanks very much for the call. Chris, I wanted to read something else you wrote. The liberal class, believing it had to fit ideas into the new sloganeering of mass communications, began to communicate in the childlike vocabulary and simplistic sound bites demanded by commercial media. Intellectual debate, once a characteristic of the country's political discourse, withered. The liberal class became seduced by the need for popular appeal, forgetting, as MacDonald wrote, that, quote, as in arts and letters, communicability to a large audience is in inverse ratio to the excellence of a political approach. This is not a good thing. As in art, it is deforming and a crippling factor. In other words, any idea that becomes popular is, by definition, deformed?
Well, popular discourse is not built around ideas. It's built around cliches and jargon. You know, most, you know, and your program remains one of the exceptions. I mean, most times that people have on the airwaves is reduced to 3 or 6 minutes. And you can't really explain ideas. You can throw out recognizable cliches that are sort of flags or signals for ideas. But to step outside the box and critique the liberal class and not be a member of the Republican Party or the Tea Party, or it's difficult because it's not easily reducible to digestible slogans or what Robert J. Lifton would call thought-terminating cliches.
Well, here's an email from Luis in Anchorage. I say, as this lifelong 63-year-old proud unreconstructed liberal, yes, 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 liberalism has failed miserably. It has failed in commitment. It has failed in message. We have lost our compass. If we don't get it back, we will lose our country. Liberal is not a pejorative. We've gotten too comfortable and too afraid to offend. My 30-year-old daughter summed it up well. She stopped attending the Quaker meeting in Seattle, a faith in which she was raised, because they would bake a casserole for any cause, but none of them would go to jail for anything. And that raises one of the last chapters of your book when you talk about resistance. What is to be done now?
Well, I don't think it's going to come through mainstream liberal mechanisms. I think it's going to come through movements. And the true correctives to American democracy have always been outside of the formal systems of power. The Liberty Party that fought slavery, the suffragists, the civil rights movement, the labor movement. None of these people achieved power in a formal sense, and yet reshape the nation. And I think that we have to go back to remaining fast to these moral imperatives. It used to be that within the liberal class or liberal institutions, we cared about the plight of the working class. And the working class, especially since the passage of NAFTA by Bill Clinton in 1994, has been destroyed. We have allowed corporations to, in some cases, literally pack up manufacturing or factories and ship them overseas. And we've not recovered from that. The service sector, the high-tech industry that was supposed to save us, has now all been outsourced to places like India or China. And we forgot that we should have stood fast with that class and not with liberal institutions and with a Democratic Party who betrayed the working class.
Here's an email from Linda in Boone, North Carolina. I think the liberal institutions have become splintered by new technologies and media exposure and thus have lost their leverage. I believe this has been part of the conservative agenda. Just building off that, among the heroes you cite in the book is the great journalist I.F. Stone, who, of course, published his own weekly out of his basement for a long period of time. Don't you think the Internet provides the opportunity to spawn a generation of Izzy Stones?
No. It provides a method of communication. The problem is that Izzy Stone charged for his weekly, and I think by the end had a circulation of about 80,000. And on the Internet, it's most people don't get paid. So it becomes very, very hard. I mean, we had this remarkable period in American journalism, courtesy of newsprint, where newsprint had a monopoly in connecting sellers with buyers. Now, with the new forms of electronic communication, these sellers no longer need newsprint to collect with buyers. And that period made it possible for journalists to earn a middle-class salary. A paper like the New York Times would invest. I mean, when I was in the Balkans, I mean, they spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on the Balkan Bureau, which I ran for them during the war, towards the end of the war in Yugoslavia. That's vanishing. I mean, large city newspapers like the Philadelphia Inquirer or the San Francisco Chronicle are struggling financially, going in and out of bankruptcy, and they're not going to be replaced. The Internet isn't going to replace that. So I worry that you know, first of all, whole cities will go dark. I mean, who's going to go down to the courts? Who's going to do the police reporting? Who's going to monitor City Hall? In the end, you have to pay rent. And while there is some good journalism done on the internet, I think one of the things that disturbs me is there's very little reporting done on the internet. I mean, most people on the internet don't even pick up a phone. There's a lot of great and insightful commentary. But reporting is a skill that I value very, very deeply, and it's a skill that if we lose, our democracy will, I think, suffer and be impoverished for it.
We're talking with Chris Hedges about his new book, Death of the Liberal Class. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Chris, the last chapter of your book is bleak. You envision a future, and I was not exaggerating at the top, where centuries of barbarism.
Well, that's what we're facing just if we don't address the ecological crisis. And all the climate change reports are out there. It is a crisis. It is an emergency. Those are not my words. Those are Hansen's words from NASA and other climate scientists who follow this. Polar ice caps are melting at an alarming rate. Methane chimneys are seeping up from the permafrost, and we're not responding. We go to Copenhagen and sit by passively as Kyoto is shredded. The economic crisis, I think, is tied to the environmental crisis. When you unfetter corporate entities, when you have unfettered capitalism, everything is turned into a commodity, human labor as well as the natural world, and they are both exploited until exhaustion or collapse. And what we're creating or allowing to be created by not checking against this corporate state or rise of corporate power is not only a kind of neo-feudalism, but a kind of willful suicide by not confronting the destruction of the ecosystem on which human life depends. So if we don't wake up and take major correctives very soon, then the future, I think, looks very bleak.
Let's see if we can get another caller in. Caroline. Caroline with us from Anchorage.
Thank you so much. My question had to do with the individual. What happened to the individual liberal that stood back and let this happen? Was it a universal sweep of greed, as I saw happening in the late 60s, early 70s? And unless our life is on the line, as it was when people protested the Vietnam War, people just don't seem to want to connect to what's going on to other people.
Yeah, Hannah Arendt calls it atomization, that disconnection from people. And I think that is an important point. We all are retreating into virtual worlds. We are mesmerized by very powerful forms of propaganda. We confuse how we are made to feel with knowledge. We've not held fast to moral imperatives that I think characterize the great social movements of the 19th and the 20th century. And we're paying a terrific price for that.
One thing you said, which I wanted to emphasize, I was having an argument, or perhaps I should say a discussion, with a friend, and my complaint was that we do not fund education evenly, and since we don't know where genius lands within the population, whenever we lose whole groups of people, the poor in disenfranchised schools, that we suffer. And their comment was they had no problem with a permanent underclass to fight our wars. And it was all I could do to restrain myself from slugging them. But trying to be nonviolent, that was not an option. But there is an attitude that is just beyond evil in my mind.
Well, that's what corporatism is about. It's about the creation of a kind of oligarchic state between masters and serfs. And you look at City College in New York before Nelson Rockefeller destroyed it. There was one of the great universities in America. And look at the leadership class that was produced by that university. These were usually first-generation immigrants, people with no money, yet, of course, amazingly bright, who had so many things to contribute to our country. And the destruction of the educational system is one that essentially empowers this tiny plutocracy and continues the perpetuation of the power elite and disenfranchise and essentially denies the kinds of tools and skills to a broader population that a democracy needs. And you cannot sustain a democracy in an oligarchic state. It's something that Plutarch and Thucydides understood and wrote about very well in ancient Athens.
Chris Hedges, thanks as always for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Neil.
Coming up, last week's elections upended the debate on many domestic issues. With President Obama in Asia this week, how will the midterms affect foreign policy? NPR senior foreign editor Lauren Jenkins joins us to talk about that. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.